Ray would the team and meet me and the girls. Well, of course, my mother rode right back. Of course you will. So they made a date, and Dad hitched up a pair of horses on the, well, called a surrey with a fringe on top, a two-seater, and went, met the train and brought them over there. And she visited there. Well, then when they got ready to go down to Waitsfield visiting, he hitched up his horses and carried her and the kid down to Waitsfield. And he took him over to Lincoln. And that's the way my dad was. He'd do anything for people. And then when they got ready to go home, he went and picked them up and brought them up. And they spent a night or two, day or two there. And then he took them to Rockford and he took the train and went home. But this is a funny thing. I'm going to tell it. You can cut it out of the tape if you want to. As I say, Gertrude was about three, and I was four. And I'm a year older. So in the old house, there was a bedroom off the kitchen that Dad and Mother slept in. And then there was a house to put the stairs, go by the stairs, went upstairs, was the living room. And in the corner looked the bedroom, and in that corner was a little corner, and they had a wooden rod and some kind of curtains up, and they called it a den. Well, the writing desk was in there, and also they could set up a half bed or something. I don't remember what half, I guess it was a half bed, three-quarter bed. I don't know. I can't remember that. But anyway, so when they had extra company, because some of the rooms upstairs weren't finished off, bedrooms, they used to put up, move a desk out and set up that bed there. So, well, they would come there the first night. They made up a bed for Jeannie and Mildred. They made up a little bed on the floor for Gertrude. And when they got around, of course, the kids had good bed first. Got Gertrude into the little bed on the floor, and I had to get rid of the bed. But I was sleeping upstairs with my brothers. And they wanted me to get in bed with Gertrude on the floor. And I wouldn't do it. I said, no, sir. Boy, oh, boy. They tried to darn it. No, I was disgusted with them. I wouldn't do it. I said, boy, I guess I probably ready to ball or something anyway. But I never forgot it. It bothered me. I wouldn't think of getting into bed with that girl, you know. Why? And to think later on I married her.
That's funny. That's a great
story. So, anyway. And then in two or three years more, they came back again. And of course, the kids were bigger. And they come up and Dad done the same thing, got them in that lake, and they stayed. And then they got so, well, I got some pictures I'll show them to you, that when they was up there, Gertrude used to like to be up around the farm with me and that lake, and run along. And so we were together a lot as little kids. And then got so when they was bigger, well, we all call her Grammy Fred. Grammy used to come up with just Gertrude. Mildred was off at school. She'd go into art school. She's an artist, and they sent her. And Gertrude, I don't know, get so old she was, but probably around 14 or so. And she used to work in the summertime when she was going to high school in a shoe factory, get a job. Some kind of job in there. They used to do piecework, and she had to keep track of them. And like, but she liked it up Vermont well, and she'd come up with her mother, and her mother wanted her to take a week's vacation and go home, but she didn't want to. She said, well, I know several times they argued. She said, Mother said, well, you lose your job. You can't get my, well, I don't care. She said, I'll get done. So she used to stay up summers. And so we got so enjoyed that, and we got so, I don't know, we got bigger and we enjoyed being around to each other. And so after get the chores done on Sunday, always had a nice horse and a nice buggy, and of course Dad had a lot of nice horses. So Gertrude used to pack up a little lunch, and I'd put up a little hay in a bag and shine up my horse and everything, and we'd start out Sunday around 10 o'clock. We'd go back some back road out of the brook. We'd hitch a horse, and I always carried a little fish line all on the end of a stick. And I'd get to the brook and I'd cut a wood fish pole and tied a line onto it, and I'd go, and sometimes Gertrude did too, we'd catch 4, 5, 6 trout. Then I'd come back down where the horse was, and we'd feed the horse some hay, and I'd take some stone, make a little arch, and then I'd get some spruce boughs and little dry branches, and build a fire, and Gertrude would dress the fish off and fry them, had a fry pan and fry. We'd cook her fish right there and have her lunch and sit around and just enjoy ourselves and till some time to go home. And we'd done that many Sundays. And then, so later on, they got so old Gertrude's dad, was kind of having not much work and kind of retired. He used to come up and stay for quite a while. And this particular time, they had so much fun, and they used to stay in a house down in Wakefield, which belonged to Gertrude's mother's aunt, and Gussie Biglow, little house. They stayed in there. And one time I know, and we used the Dan Cardle house, where the sugar house was, to store sap buckets and stuff in, because nobody lived in it. And so that particular year, they stayed up and got pictures wherever they were around on the farm with us. And I got pictures of Grampy Fred sitting up on the piazza and smoking his cigar. And she said to my dad, she said, oh, I wish, she said, we had a place that we could come to and didn't have to have stuff moved out for us and stay, and we'd like to stay some years, and we'd like to sometimes stay up here till after Christmas and spend Christmas up here. Of course, Mildred was off to want there, and I like, and so Dad said, well, he said, oh, the old Dan place, he says, that old house there, he says, if you want to fix it up inside, paper and fix it up, he says, I've kept the roof good and it's all good, and the floors are good. Of course, there's no heat in it, but he says, only we could set up a stove. And he says, if you want to fix it up, he says, we'll move the buckets and stuff we got stored in there to put them somewhere else. And he says, you can have it to use. He says, one cottage thing, we'll let you use it. Well, they were tickled to pieces with it, so they fixed it all up, and they came up there for 3 years and spent the summer there and stayed sometime till after Christmas. And so this particular time, during this time, Gertrude's sister Mildred and her husband, and they had a little boy Dean, come up. This was in the summer. They come up for vacation, see. Of course, they stayed over there. There was 2 bedrooms, and Gertrude's dad used to gun for the Boston market. He and a fella from Selbridge, they used to gun for the market there in Boston. And quail and pheasants and all that kind of stuff. They used to, every fall, they'd go out and they'd bring birds in and make some money. He had a beautiful, beautiful shotgun. Oh, he thought the world of it. Well, anyway, so they had a couch in the kitchen there with a, I think they called it a chenille cover or something. And of course, Harold Rippon, Mildred's husband, smoked a lot of cigars. And so this particular morning, and I was up from Lynn, I was living in Lynn at the time then. I went down to Lynn and married down to Lynn, and we come up on our vacation.
Oh, so you married Gertrude?
Yeah, this yeah. That was after we married. We married in 1924, 68 years ago this Sunday, I was married. March 29th, 1924. And so Gertrude and I came up, having my vacation. I was working for the, I guess I was working for the foreman of the Lingad Electric Company at that time. We come up to my folks, and Harold Mildred and little Dean was staying over to the Dan Cardle house with her folks. And so this particular day, they was Harold Mildred, they were going to come over to the farm, and Harold was bringing little Dean sitting on his shoulders. And near as we could figure, a little breeze, and he came out and left door opened, and there was steps out there. They wasn't a porch, but they were just a step. Some sparks flew from that cigar, or he smoked a pipe sometimes, a cob pipe. And they got almost out the house, right near the house. And Harold turned around and said, "Oh my God, that house is afire." And of course, Grammy Fred and Grandpa Fred had come over earlier in the day to the farm. And so, well, boy, I took out and started on the run, and my brother Lord did it. Well, I run faster than the rest of them. I was younger, I guess, and I run faster. And Harold says, "My under the bed is my pocketbook." Well, of course, I was excited. I didn't use my head. If I had, I could save something. But I was the first one to get there. And they had cloth screens over the windows to keep flies out. And I should have waited a few seconds to get my breath. But I went to that bedroom window and I tore that screen off and I leaped right into that room. And it's a wonder I ever came out. What I intended to do was going to go into that and going to shut the door, bedroom door. But I didn't get to the door. Oh, I sucked in so much smoke and I nearly blacked out. And I crawled out back out of the window and I was laying on the ground when Lauren, my brother, got there. And I said, "Don't go in there." I said, "That place is full of smoke. The wind is boiling right in there." I said, I was coughing and strangling. And I know my brother raised me up and he said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm all right." And, but we couldn't save a thing. Mm-hmm. And so pocketbook and dad, we called him Dad, Grammy Fred's beautiful shotgun was in the cupboard. Everything went. We couldn't save a blooming thing. So that's what happened to the old Dan Cardle house. But a little excitement. And that ended their coming up and spending the summers up there. But so they went back when they did come up and visit, come stay with my folks or go down to Waitsfield and stay. But that's kind of a coincidence.
Well, now, your father was a great horse trainer and a great horseman.
Well, that's where we boys got our training.
Well, I'm interested in where he learned, because he was really thought of as...
I don't know what Earl told you, but I'll tell you what his dad told me, and I've heard him tell a good many times. When he was 14 years old, he bought his first horse, a 3-year-old stallion, just Halderbrook. And of course, he was living at home. His father was no great of a horseman, and his brothers, none of his brothers were. They could drive him, but they never. But Dad was one of a million. He was born right in him. He seemed to know how to do everything. And that, I thank you for what I know. And so he trained that stallion. And how he got to be a veterinarian was he never went to college or anything, got a school on it. When the neighbors, back in them days, they, of course, calves and killed to be sick, they had veterinaries. Well, I got a little extension that I'm on a party line.
Oh.
That's a neighbor's ring. So when the neighbors had a sick cow or horse or whatever, he heard about it, he'd go to the neighbors to see how it acted. He was that interested. And if it died, he said to the people, "Well, Dad, can I cut it open and see what's wrong?" And he did. And that's where he got his education on starting to be a veterinarian, because he watched the animal to see how it acted when they're sick. And the veterinarians would then give them, they didn't have the medicine they have today, of course, but dose them best they could and they died. And then he'd go back and cut them open and see what the problem was. And from that, he kept reading books and that like, and the first thing he knew, neighbor had something sick here, but he'd go down there and he'd maybe dose it. And from that, he kept going dose. So after many years, he was what I called a real good veterinarian. They wasn't anything, of course, they didn't have needles to give shots and that stuff. He'd done everything the old-fashioned way, but that man was busy. And of course, Earl left home. He was one of the first ones. He got married and he left home. And then Lauren and Clarence and I was there. And, you know, we'd go out in the morning to do farm work. We never knew whether Dad would be there all day or what. Maybe he'd be out in the field, he might be plowing or whatever. And next the phone and ring, Mother'd come out and ring a bell, and somebody had a sick horse or a sick cow or a cow couldn't freshen. And one of us boys would take a team and step into his foot track and go ahead, and he'd go and hitch up a horse and go. Maybe he'd be gone for 2 or 3 hours, depending on how far he had to go. And he always stayed until that animal was better. And he'd get called out in the middle of the night somewhere. He'd go and dose that animal, and when he come home, the horse or cow or anything was better. And that's the way he learned. The sad thing is, that man was so capable of knowing just what to do and no education on it, taught himself and reading books. He had a lot of big doctorate books, that he never wanted to let some of us boys, we knew a few things, but he never let us know all the stuff that he used. And I don't know what Earl told you, but I remember he telling me several times, I'd ask him questions, and he says, you know, he said, don't let everybody know what you do. If you let everybody know what you do, he says, they won't want you. Don't tell everybody how to do something. Well, back in those days, if you had something that somebody else couldn't do, the money was, and that was his idea, because money was tight, and he could go out and pick up a little extra money doing veterinary work, and also save the farmer's money, because he didn't charge like a vet did. But the sad part was, why didn't he leave us the recipes of some of the stuff that he made up?
How did he learn to make that stuff up?
Don't ask me. I don't ask me, but just experimenting and trying. And he had, back here, oh, quite a few years ago, I was down in Plainfield, New Hampshire. And there was Bronk Farns, was an old horse jockey down there, and knew my dad. And I was down there doing horses for him. He was getting along here and not too well. And so my name got down around there, and so I went down there, and I got talking with him. And he says, you wouldn't have to be Elijah Fuller's boy, would you? And I said, well, I guess it happened to be that I am. Well, he says, a great man, great man. He says, that man, he says, had more knowledge on horses, and he says, boy, he knew how to dose them. He says, I was pretty good myself. And we talked, said, well, after a year or so, he passed away, and I was doing some horses for his daughter, which was a great horsewoman and had Morgans. And I went to her place, and her husband had a portable sawmill. I was up to her plate and did her heart to tea, and then she always had to visit with me because we talked about Bronk and my dad, and went and had some coffee. And I don't know what happened, but then we got talking about, she said, you know, my father used to be called out nights to dose horses with the colic. And she says he had a colic medicine. She says he never tell anybody what caused, but she says if he got there when they first began to be colic, he'd give them a dose of it, he says, in half an hour time, he says it was better. And she says, well, I says, wait a minute. I said, you're bringing back kind of memories. She says, well, let me go out in the barn. She says, I've got one of the bottles. And show you what the bottle was, a round bottle. And in that bottle was probably, I don't believe it was a half a teaspoonful, it might have been, in that bottle of greenish liquid. And I says, for heaven's sakes, I don't know what Dad used, but that was the same color. And time again, when I was a young kid, we'd be breaking colts. A lot of time Dad, when I was young, he'd say, well, we'll hitch up that colt and I'll get my stuff in my case. And we'll go and doctor that sick horse. And you kind of tend to the colt while he's being hitched outside to get uneasy and, you know, and that like. And so I used to go drive for him and that like. And whatever that was a greenish liquid. And I remember, he had 2 tablespoonfuls in a long, and of course they had to use a long neck bottle in to drench them. He put 2 tablespoonfuls of that into that bottle and a pint of warm water and shake it and pour it in that horse. And 9 times out of 10, that horse just started to be colicky in a half an hour, so that horse would eat and it would be better. And so I asked Dad one time, I said, what is that? Oh, he said, some stuff I rigged up. And I don't know to this day, nobody else knows. And old Bronc Farnsworth wouldn't tell his daughter. He says, it's a secret. Now she said, that's a shame. I said, I know it.
Did you learn any of his remedies?
A few, but not too many.
Which remedies did you learn?
Well, I learned some of the stuff that he used to use for cuts and things like that, and to give them for bots and different things like that. And then one time, this was interesting. I think I was a young kid, and we were breaking a cold for somebody, and she was one of those that Dad says didn't have too much between her ears. You get her and drive a beautiful day, and tomorrow when you hitch her up, you start out with her, you wouldn't think she'd ever been harnessed. So he had to go, either had to go to Montpelier or over to Bristol to a drugstore. He needed some stuff, so he said to me, let's hitch up that foolish colt. He says, we'll drive her over to Bristol and back. Maybe, he says, she won't forget it. And he said, of course, over the mountain, you know, and it's quite a little drive. So we started out right after breakfast and went over to Bristol, put up to Dan Lane, his cousin's over in Bristol. And we had dinner there and went down to the drugstore. Of course, put the colt in the Dan's barn and went down to the drugstore. And he had written down on paper what he wanted, passed it to the druggist. The druggist took it and looked at it. And Dan knew the druggist in the drugstore, but Dan was one time used to, I don't know, he was a sheriff or something, and used to patrol nights around with a great big dog, one of them big dogs. Anyway, he says, Dan introduced him to Dad there, and he said, Mr. Fuller, are you a licensed veterinarian? Dad said, no, I ain't got a license. And he said, I don't know if I can fill that. And Dad said, why? Well, he says, I know what's in there. Well, Dad said, I do. Dad said, I don't have no problem getting it filled in Montpelier. I live in Warren, and he said, so I come over here to try to get it over here and have a little visit with Dan and exercise a colt. And before he got around, he said, well, he said, you know that stuff will eat hide, hair, and bone? Dad said, I know it. It's a blister. I want a blister to take a spavin off the horse. And so he filled a prescription. But he called it a Spanish fly blister. Now, I don't know where that name come from, but I don't know what was in it. But he used to take bog spavins off the horses. That's a bunch on their hind leg, hard like a bone, and he'd put it on there, and it'll blister and sweat it out and take that bunch off. But I have no idea what was in it.
Earl told me once about some remedy from a frog that he used to put on a bad knee of a horse.
Yeah, well,
and I don't know whether he learned that from his father, your father, or not.
Yeah, but he did.
Because I'm fascinated, as you say, it's forgotten.
That's right.
And that's why I feel interviewing is so important, because although many of the people you talk to can read and write, they don't choose to, but they have this fund of knowledge.
Yeah. But I say it's too bad that he wasn't freer. He showed us boys certain things to do, like floating teeth.
So that's who you learned floating teeth from?
Oh, yes. I never went to school on it. And none of the boys did. And also, he taught us boys, all of us, to shoe horses. He had a blacksmith shop, and he was a corrective shoer. He'd bring horses there that was limping and that like, and when he set the shoe and fixed them up, they walked off and went limping. And he had a blacksmith shop and that like, and he taught all us boys to do that. I've shot a lot of horses, and I know how to. In fact, I've dosed bone horses over the years, and I like with a bottle and stuff and drench them and put it into them, and I like. And so he was wonderful at that, but he was a very hard teacher. Of course, I was the last one. And another thing, why he was a hard teacher, that kind of stuff comes so easy to him that the first time we did something, he thought we ought to do it like he did. Well, you ought to, it shouldn't be so, he called it gomming, doing this, and you ought to be doing better, you know.
He called it what?
Gomming.
Gomming?
I don't know how to spell it, but don't be so condemned, never sore, but condemned. Don't be so condemned gomming, doing that. You ought to be able to use your hands or those, and, you know, well, you know, irritating to a kid or what to me. And I'm telling you, I don't know how many colts, or his horses, that I worked on their teeth before he ever told me I did a good job. And this is a story I've put on over the years, many, many demonstrations. I've got a horse's skull, which I show you, and you've seen it, I guess. Floating horse's teeth. I do it for 4-H riding clubs and different organizations. And I'm bragging a little. I've been told by other vets that asked me to come and ask me how to do it teeth. I've been told, but I guess it's true, I think I'm the only man that ever demonstrated floating hearts and teeth with a skull to the public.
I think that's probably true.
I know I'm the only man in the state of Vermont ever done it. And so, well, I feel kind of proud of myself for that.
Should.
But people have asked me, how many years you been doing it? And I say, this is what I tell them. I said, from 17 years on, off and on. 7 years on Matt Judas, I didn't do it, of course. But why 17? I was 17 years old, and Warren was a mill town. Probably Earl told you a lot about the mills in Warren. Several mills all run by water power except the steam mill. One mill run water in the spring, and then when Logan had a steam engine, the board mill. But there was a clapboard mill, a buttertub mill, a butterbaked grist mill, knobton mill, clothespin mill, and all those mills down through Warren was operated by mill power, water power. Well, anyway, so this time Arthur Prey, it used to be Pliny Parker's business, a clapboard mill, lumber mill, rich man, he passed away. And Harvey Jones married Pliny Parker's daughter. And his daughter married Arthur Prey. Well, when Harvey Jones retired, got old and couldn't do anything, Arthur Prey came in and took over the business. So, of course, all the hauling of materials of all those mills had to go over Rockford Mountain to the railroad. So in the spring, long in the last of March, in the 1st of April, they'd bring horses up out of my dad's, and we had two clipping machines, and we used to clip their winter coats off. And the clipping machine we had was Stuart clipper, but they was stood up and you had to turn a crank. So we had two machines, and of course, boy's job to turn the crank. And we clipped four horses that day for Arthur Prey. And when he got through, he says, Elijah, he says, before I take the horses home, I want you to do their teeth. So Dad went and got his float and his pail and stuff, and he did one. Then he said to Art, he said, you mind if my boy does one? And I said, heck no, go ahead. Well, now maybe I wasn't nervous, because my dad was so fussy. Because time and time again, he'd always said, well, you're improving, but your angle ain't just right. You don't go back and get that last molar or something, you know, never quite right. Then he asked me to do that horse and that man there. Well, so I took a float and I went up there. I say I was nervous. I did this side, and I did the other side, and I checked his under teeth. They didn't need anything done. When he got through, Dad says, "Well, I'm going to see what you did." And he walked up and put his hand harsh on the nose and put his thumb up and felt of his teeth. Turned around, felt the other side, pulled his tongue out, looked up in there. He said, "Well," he said, "you did a good job." And that was the first time and I was ever told I did a good job. So I tell people, well, I've been doing it off and on since 17. That's why the 17 came in on. And so from that, I've been doing it. And I don't know, I've done thousands.
Did you do, because Earl did.
Right? Oh, yes.
And he, again, had learned from your father?
Yeah, oh, yes. What Earl knew about doing doctoring horses and training was all from his father. And Earl was good at it. And he could train.
And your father trained as well.
Oh, yes, yes. And you know, a lady came in here the other night. I didn't know she'd lived over here since July. She used to live up in Granville somewhere. Her name is Powers now. And last Saturday they had a doings over here to the college on tag and that like, and I went over and she met me and she says, "You Earl Fuller's brother?" And I said, "Yes." Well, she said, "I knew Earl when I was," she's 30 years old. She came in and see me the other night since then. And she told me, she says, "I used to talk to your brother quite a lot." She said, "I love horses and have horses." And she said, "He taught me, told me how to train my horse so it, when I was riding, I wanted to stop and pick up one foot and tip his head down the bell. He told me how to do it," she said, "and it worked." So Earl told her how to train it. And of course, Earl had trained him like my dad to lay down and roll over and set up. And so I've got a picture of Earl standing in front of old Don Jay out in the back room in a frame, setting up. And Dad, of course, used to take him to fairs and show off with him and enter him as a gentleman driver. And probably Earl told you about that, too. About his playing dead over the fair?
I'm not sure. Remind me.
Well, this was, I was a young boy when it happened, when you were a little fella. But anyway, Dad, for several years, he and John Manchester from Randolph, and I forget the other one, was horse judge over at the Northfield Fair, Dog River Valley Fair. And back in those days, the horses that they showed, not racing, but show horses, they didn't ride them hardly at all. They were either in a four-wheel buggy or a cart. And they drove them. And Dad was one of the judges. And so he had old Don over there, and so I don't know who drove him anyway, but he always used to come over to the Blue Room because my dad was one of the best horse trainers. I don't think there's anything like him today that could do any better job than he did. And when he trained the horse, he'd drive up and say, "Whoa," and he stood there and his head was...